This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
But just days before the launch, Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, announced President Muhammadu Buhari would not attend. A government statement said key stakeholders, a reference to the business community and trade unions, had not been consulted about their concerns on the treaty.
That's VOA correspondent Daniel Sheriff in East Africa reporting on the difficulties ahead in realizing an African free trade region. Details coming up also. Girls abducted by Boko Haram from the northeastern town of Dapchi last month have been returned, and thousands of children have been used as combatants in the troubled Kasai region of the DRC. We have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the Nigerian government says most of the girls abducted by Boko Haram from the northeastern town of Dapchi last month have been returned. As Chika Aduwa reports, parents of the released girls are happy and relieved to have their children back.
The Nigerian government has confirmed that the majority of the 110 schoolgirls believed to have been abducted by a Boko Haram faction just over a month ago were released Wednesday morning. AFP reported that the girls were brought back to the remote farming town of Dapchi in the northern Nigerian state of Yobe by their abductors in a convoy of 9 vehicles. Media reports said that 5 of the girls died along the way, but a Yobe state government official said this could not yet be ascertained. Nigeria's Minister of Information, Lai Mohammed, said the early morning release was unconditional and was a result of back-channel efforts with the help of some friends of the country.
91 girls and one boy have been documented to have been released. It's developing. And many of the girls, many of the students that were released were not dropped in one place. They were dropped on the road. And they went back, of course, naturally to their parents' houses.
Sources on the ground told VOA that the residents of Dapchi are rejoicing. Parents, who were once mourning, are now celebrating. Yahaya Tarbutu is one of them. He spoke to VOA from Dapchi. He said that 3 of his daughters came back.
I have Amina Yahaya Tarbutu, I have Fatima Yahaya Tarbutu, and Mariam Mohamed Kaku. Seriously, they are happy. I got them since in the morning around 8. We are together with them. I take them, I go and take bath, they go and take bath, I give them pop and bread, they eat bread. I feel, whoa, but I can't say anything for that now.
His 3 daughters are now on their way to a government hospital in the Yobe state capital for a health checkup. VOA was able to reach one of the released girls as she explained to her father about her time in Boko Haram captivity. The girl, 15-year-old Fatuma Abdullahi, said that she and her classmates were not harmed. She also said that 2 of her friends were among the ones who died en route to Dapchi. I swear to God, they didn't do anything to us. We were the ones who were cooking for ourselves, and they provided the means. Aisha and Maimuna were among the 5 girls who died. Questions are being raised about the nature of the release. VOA spoke to the Nigerian president's spokesperson, Shehu Garba. He did not confirm nor deny that a ransom had been paid. However, another government official, Yobe State Representative Khadija Ibrahim, said no money had been exchanged. Last week, President Muhammadu Buhari had visited Dapchi and had assured the parents that the girls would be released through negotiations rather than by military force. On Tuesday, Amnesty International said the Nigerian military ignored repeated warnings about the movements of Boko Haram fighters before the kidnapping. The military denied the claim. The Nigerian government says it is still trying to rescue many of the Chibok schoolgirls who were kidnapped in April 2014. More than 100 of them are still missing. Chika Odua in Dakar for VOA News.
Thousands of children in the troubled Kasai region of the Democratic Republic of Congo have been used as combatants over the last 2 years amid conflict between local militia and government forces. That's according to the United Nations Children's Fund, which also estimates the violence has impacted as many as 60% of local children. Some 1,000 children have trickled into rehabilitation centers run by aid agencies. VOA's Anita Powell met with some of them. She reports from Kananga in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The horrors these children endured come back to them in whispers, fragments, and nightmares. That's Muyaya, a lean, shy boy of 16 who says he joined the Kamuina Nsapu militia in 2016. His story unfolded haltingly over the course of an hour as dozens of his neighbors thronged around, eager to hear details that he is clearly uncomfortable recalling. VOA interviewed him in the presence of counselors from a rehabilitation center, run by a Christian charity and UNICEF, and with the permission of his legal guardian, his uncle. He did not give details about what violence he may have seen or committed. Some 1,000 children like Muyaya have been rehabilitated since conflict flared up in this region 18 months ago, but UNICEF estimates that as many as 10,000 children were involved in the militia. Rehabilitation is a slow and complex task, says Oscar Butragueño, UNICEF's emergency coordinator in Kasai.
When they've lived these traumas, it's even difficult to bring together and put together a memory. It's made of bits and pieces of things that have happened. Sometimes they were used under the effects of drugs. During the conflict, children would be given a prominent role when they were fighting the military. The boys were sent in advance because under the magical perception that the bullets wouldn't kill them, which obviously is not the case. And then the girls would be sent second, in the second line, because they thought that their skirts would actually absorb the bullets as well.
Muyaya said this is exactly what happened to him. Militants handed him a stick that they said would magically protect him, and sent him and other boys headfirst into pitched battles. He says he wasn't afraid. Rather, he was hypnotized and unable to feel fear. Muyaya said he had agreed to tell his story to journalists to help him move on. In the presence of counselors, VOA spoke to 5 children, most of them in their teens, who were thought to have been involved in militia activities. Not a single one could describe the cause their lives were risked for. The conflict began in 2016 after local traditional leaders clashed with security forces. UN rights investigators accused both sides of committing heinous crimes. More than 1.4 million people fled that violence. Earlier this week, the UN Security Council discussed the situation across Congo, where top humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said 13 million people now need aid. All these details matter a little to children who were caught up in the violence. When I ran away from the militia, says 14-year-old Nona Marie, a resident at a UNICEF-sponsored rehabilitation center for children involved in the conflict, I forgot everything. UNICEF is calling for $11.5 million this year to help reintegrate children after they've left armed groups. That process is slow and complex, workers at the rehabilitation center say. They pointed to a little girl with a serious face and a dress two sizes too big. She says her name is Anita and doesn't know her last name, the name of her village, or where her parents might be. She says they fled in separate directions when the fighting started. She says she's 11, but adults at the center say she can't be older than 9. Workers at the center say it has taken them weeks to piece together a narrative. They believe Anita's father was a policeman who joined the militia. They don't know if he primed her for militia service or what her role was. Only one detail, they say, shines reliably and repeatedly through Anita's muddled memory. My mother's name, she says, is Mbombo. She's beautiful. Her hair is dark and curly. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kananga, Democratic Republic of Congo.
African Union heads of state today launched what could become the world's largest free trade zone, the African Continental Free Trade Area. But with 54 countries in the AU, each with its own economic and political concerns, the effort has many hurdles to clear before it can become a reality. VOA's Daniel Sheriff reports from Nairobi.
Handshakes, smiles, and jubilation accompanied the long-awaited launch of the African Continental Free Trade Area on Wednesday in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. The trade bloc has been in negotiation since 2012, when the African Union first decided on a continent-wide plan. It aims to create a single market for goods and services, free movement of business and investments, and establish a customs union to regulate tariffs. Erastus Mwencha is former deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission and former secretary general of the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa.
Africa is one continent that does not trade with itself like the rest of the world. And because of that, the huge demographic dividend of the continent is not of any advantage to the continent because Africa has not taken advantage of its market size, which is 1.3 billion people plus a GDP of over 2.3 trillion.
But the Kigali launch, while significant, is largely symbolic, as many challenges remain before the trade deal can be implemented, let alone become effective. Gerishon Ikiara is Associate Director of the Institute of Diplomacy and International Studies at the University of Nairobi and an economist. He notes that Africa faces many political, social, and economic barriers to integration.
There is also often a bit of conflict between the French-speaking Africa, the English-speaking Africa, the Maghreb, Arab part of Africa in North Africa. Then you have a few dominant economies like South Africa and Nigeria, and the small ones like Rwanda.
African trade is dominated by the export of raw materials to Asia and the West and import of finished goods. One of the reasons is because national markets operate like silos, says Mwencha.
If you look at some of the economies in Africa, with a population of half a million people, a population of 3 million people, population of 5 million people, with very little purchasing power, you cannot be able to really advance economically, and so you require a bigger market.
The African Union says reducing barriers to trade within the continent will boost manufacturing and value-added products and services. But just days before the launch, Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, announced President Muhammadu Buhari would not attend. A government statement said key stakeholders, a reference to the business community and trade unions, had not been consulted about their concerns on the treaty. Some economists warned that without Nigeria's participation, the African CFTA will be severely handicapped. However, national consultations are understandable, says Mwencha.
That is okay, but one hopes that this doesn't drag because Nigeria perhaps may take a position that is a large country with almost 170 million people that they can do without continent. That will be a very unfortunate position.
For the 44 countries who signed on to the deal this week, the next step will be getting their national parliaments to ratify the free trade deal, which could take years. The 10 other countries in the AU would also have to sign on for the deal to be continent-wide. Regional integration could be a bigger challenge for Africa than it was for Europe. But while the EU took more than half a century to establish itself with just 28 members, economists like Ikiara expect it will take years, not decades, for Africa.
Right now also, we are having improvement in terms of infrastructure. Ports which are connected with each other, railways and roads which are interconnecting more African countries. And I think that connectivity, I see it as being a major push, because once the interconnectivity is improved, the private sector becomes even more effective.
Despite the challenges ahead, the trade bloc's launch Wednesday is another step by African nations toward closer integration. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Nairobi.
19 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. South Sudan says it has managed to interrupt the transmission of guinea worm disease. Riak Gaykok, the country's Minister of Health, made the announcement today at the Carter Center in the United States. South Sudan has gone 15 months without recording a case of Guinea worm because the worm's life cycle is about a year. That gap, without cases, indicates transmission has stopped. The World Health Organization has certified 199 countries, territories, and areas as free of Guinea worm disease. The Carter Center says Chad and Ethiopia each reported 15 cases in 2017, the only cases in the world. Guinea worm disease is eradicated by filtering drinking water to eliminate larvae. About a year after a person ingests the larvae, a meter-long worm begins to emerge painfully and slowly from the body. The worm removal and recovery can disable people. The Carter Center says that in 1986, Guinea worm disease affected an estimated 3.5 million people in 21 countries in Africa and Asia. The United Nations Refugee Agency says some 3.5 million refugee children are not able to attend school. A majority are in Africa, where they have suffered loss, dislocation, and other trauma from war and civil conflict in their home countries. A three-day regional meeting in Nairobi this week brought together policymakers, education experts, campaigners, and representatives from UN agencies to seek ways to address the problem. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Teams from Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, and Uganda took part in the deliberations. Issues included the impact of conflict and natural disasters on providing education, inequalities among marginalized groups, and sustainable access to quality education. Leonora Makuen is a program specialist at the International Institute for Educational Planning.
It's a global crisis with more than 65 million displaced population, displaced people throughout the world, of which half of those are children, right? So 1 in 45 children are refugees today. Increasingly, displacement lasts years, right? So children are missing entire education cycles, and we're missing out generations of learning. So it's the scale is enormous, and 80% of refugees are actually in developing countries.
According to the United Nations, developing countries, mostly in Africa, are taking a disproportionate number of refugees, about 80% of the world's refugee population. South Sudan is among the countries in Africa engulfed in civil war. Deng Deng Hok is the country's Minister of Education.
We have still 1.8 million children out of school. We have about 2 million, just over 2 million in our schools, which is a big achievement compared to, 300,000 in 2006. We still need to improve the quality of education. Currently, it is variable from one school to another. We need to invest in in-service teacher training. We need to implement the new school inspection system. There are many reforms that need to be implemented to address the issues of access, quality, and equity.
Refugees hosted in developing countries put enormous pressure on education, water, and healthcare systems in host communities. In Kenya, for example, hundreds of thousands of refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from Somalia and South Sudan, have been living in the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps. Kenya's Director of Education, Robert Masese, says hosting the displaced populations brings challenges.
I was handling an issue about the conflicts between the refugee community in the Dadaab refugee camp and the Kakuma refugee camps. The host communities were feeling disadvantaged in access to resources that would have otherwise been meant for them, because they thought that the refugee populations were taking away what would otherwise be for the children. In some instances, they were having a feeling that maybe refugee environments were more favorable to the children of the refugees than the environments obtaining in the immediate neighborhoods or in the host communities which maybe they don't have water, health services, protection, or security and all that.
Governments in Eastern Africa have made significant progress enrolling refugee children in school. On the other hand, countries hosting high numbers of displaced persons often struggle to provide quality services for all children and youth. But effective coordination and collaboration among education partners can provide lasting solutions, as Leonora explains.
It's a crisis really of solidarity. So I think it's about joint planning, joint efforts with host communities, with refugee communities, but also with ministries of education and their partners. There are equal opportunities really for refugees, internally displaced children as well, for all displaced populations, so that it's a shared effort, and we're all aiming towards the same learning outcomes, and all children should be learning, you know, the same thing and should be having access to equitable and quality education.
Campaigners say refugee children are 5 times less likely to attend school than other children. Even for those who can access education, the quality is almost invariably poor. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thousands of English-speaking Cameroonians continue to flee violent crackdowns by government forces. The UN Refugee Agency reports the number of Anglophone Cameroonian asylum seekers in Nigeria has doubled since mid-January. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency has registered more than 20,000 Cameroonian refugees in Nigeria's Cross River, Taraba, Benue, and Akwa Ibom states. An overwhelming majority are women and children. A recent assessment mission by the UNHCR and several other UN agencies presents a dismal picture of the conditions under which the refugees are forced to live, with barely enough food to survive. The agencies say most families are down to one meal a day. They lack clean water and risk getting sick from drinking water from unsafe streams and ponds. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Kididi says the asylum seekers lack essential relief items and have no proper or independent shelters that can protect them from the cold. She warns this already grim situation is likely to worsen as the rainy season begins.
Malaria is reportedly already on the increase. Children commonly exhibit rapid breathing and coughing. Many participants at the assessment were suffering from fear and anxiety, poor sleep, and flashbacks. In all, about 20 to 30% of the asylum seekers have some kind of vulnerability, such as a physical disability.
Residents of Cameroon's two English-speaking provinces have long felt marginalized by the government. Their grievances erupted into deadly protests toward the end of 2016. Tensions between the English and French-speaking communities have continued to build, culminating with the first mass exodus of refugees into Nigeria in October 2017. Katidi tells VOA the situation in some parts of Cameroon continues to be very tense.
There is still a military presence and curfews that are ongoing. For UNHCR, it is important for the government of Cameroon to explore ways in which to engage with all those who feel aggrieved for the sake of peace. And we also reiterate the need for the respect of human rights by all parties involved.
Katidi says the UNHCR will continue to assist the refugees for as long as possible. Unfortunately, she says the outlook is bleak as her agency is out of funds. She says no money has been received to implement the agency's $18 million humanitarian operation for Cameroon refugees this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. And please stay tuned for Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC.
Hello. Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.